Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time, today being Friday, the 17th of March, 2006, St. Paddy's Day. Now, if you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time or HOT, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com. That's hourofthetime.com. My personal email address, if you'd like to ask questions, comments, complain, what have you, it's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. hourofthetime@hotmail.com. And the studio phone number is 928-333-2942. 928-333-2942. And keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, that when you use the studio phone number, you can't leave me your life story. Be to the point. First, get your name and contact information on there before you forget. So many of you leave messages and want me to get back with you or get together about some research, and then I have no clue how to get hold of you because you never tell me. So get your contact information out of the way first, then don't ramble on forever. Some of you leave 5 and 6 messages consecutively. If you do that, I'm going to erase them. So, to the point, and tell me what you need or what you can share, or where you can share some research, etc. You're an author. Want to share your book. All right. Now, ladies and gentlemen, remember that you're listening to the Hour of the Time on Christian Media Network via AM and FM affiliate, satellite link, and internet feeds. And remember, the Hour of the Time is listener-supported, and without your support, we cannot maintain our operations on the air. And today, again, is Friday the 17th of March, 2006, St. Paddy's Day. And we're going to kind of go into the history of St. Patrick and the clover and the Celtic cross and recipes and music and a little lore in that whole genre for today. I hope everybody has a good time today. St. Patrick's Day is a wonderful day. You should go out. It's a wonderful day for a few things because so much of the symbolism, which we're going to cover, surrounds, it was a codified system of who was on what side through various movements in Europe, that it's a wonderful day to think about our heritage in America and where we came from as far as our beginnings and where we're at today. So I think you really ought to carefully think about all these. Now, we're going to interlace some different musical tunes from some old recordings I have, some newer recordings, and cover some lore, etc. So, I suggest during this musical tune, because I have some recipes for you also, you get something to write with for the symbolism, for the recipes. So, if you want to eat good tonight, because we're after the show, I have to go and turn my brisket around in the oven and put on the basting, etc., for the final part. We're not even waiting till tonight. It's too good to wait till typical dinner time to eat. So here we are with some tunes, and then be right back. Be ready to write. was Carroll, and he's an Irish harper, and he has a group that plays traditional music around the world. They meet. Now, if you'd like to hear some more of the traditional type music selections, it's an easy search on the internet, but I'll give you a site here. It's www.hober.com. A lot of various folk music from around the world in different periods, not just Irish folk music, etc. So there's a good source if you want to hear and download. It's a really good site. I suggest you go check it out. Now, the Irish and St. Patrick's Day has various stories as to how certain things came about. The symbolism of the shamrock, St. Patrick himself. You have to remember that in those times it was quite common when someone was sainted or was a leader of clans, etc. Throughout Europe, oftentimes different clans wanted possession of their remains. So oftentimes even the stories of where they're buried is different depending on what clan told the best story, and of course he would be buried in their area. Oftentimes they wanted to be able to brag about that. And sometimes even for instance in St. Patrick's case, it's sometimes believed that if you had in your area his jawbone, which is theoretically kept in a silver cask, that it would keep away the evil eye. And we need to keep away a lot of evil eyes nowadays. Look on your dollar bill. But a lot of times people also associate this holiday in the Irish culture with the humor, the food, the festivities. So I want to give you a excellent recipe that I have. I got it from a gal. She's dead now, but she left me this recipe a long time ago. Anyway, if you have your brisket, this is really good. Try it. You need 16 ounces of beer. I guess you could substitute, but go buy a can of beer. And quarter pound or stick of butter. You cover it with foil and bake. 350 for a couple hours. Then, when that's almost done, that first 2 hours, make yourself up a base. And you'd use dry mustard, Coleman's, what have you, brown sugar and water, and make it into a thick paste. At the end of that first 2 hours baking, you take the brisket out, of course, uncover it, score the fatty side of the brisket. Then you put that paste that you've made up of the mustard, water, and brown sugar, brush that all real heavy on there, and that'll make a marinade / crust on it, and put it back in and bake it for another hour. Now, if you want a few other recommendations, the brown sugar, etc., with the brisket makes a wonderful meal, not the healthiest in the world. Typically, you would make a home-style version ginger ale. Now, this is definitely not the healthiest thing in the world. You take equal amounts of water and sugar, first off. Let's say a cup of water, then use a cup of sugar. What you're doing is you're going to boil that cup of water, and as soon as it comes to a boil, you stir in that cup of sugar, whatever the equal amounts you choose. And as you stir it in to the boiling water, it'll try to cool down a little bit, but just keep it up there. Stir that in, only takes a minute, and that makes your syrup base. Into that, the only healthy thing in this recipe is 6 to 8 slices, the size of a quarter and a little thicker, of ginger root. Throw that in there and let that simmer for another 15 minutes or so. That syrup with the ginger root. Then if you take that, and that's your base, you take that with 2 or 3 tablespoons of that base now, put it in a glass of ice, and then pour over that club soda. And you have a homemade ginger ale that's much better than anything you're going to get out of a tap or out of a bottle or can. And then, of course, a typical accompaniment would be the dry bread, various names around the world. Hardtack is the derivative of it that the mountain men used. A lot of the mountain men being Scottish and Irish. And a lot of the early settlers, and in the Revolutionary War, a lot of the utility things used throughout early America especially came from Irish society. So hence a lot of these recipes. also the hardtack being becoming really the first standardized military ration. Britain had theirs that they attempted several times. They just kept having a bad habit of putting it in containers that were lined with lead to preserve it, and it didn't work too good on the soldiers down the road. But another one is your large herder's bread, loaves. Then, of course, boil some red potatoes, and potatoes, there's the oaky coming out in me, and cabbage, and this will probably be the only healthy part of your whole meal, the cabbage. So steam it. Try to get a little health with this meal. The cabbage, if you steam it, just remember the best way, and this is for all steamed vegetables from an herbal standpoint, boil your water first. So you've got the steam generating, you're not slowly heating up and leaching out those minerals and vitamins, then put the basket in there or tray. You can improvise it if you don't have a steamer for a stovetop. And then do your vegetables. They should still be crisp and just warm, and they'll be full of your vitamins and minerals still. Like I said, that's probably the only healthy part of the whole meal. But it's a good, normal, traditional meal. You can put that cabbage in at the end with the potatoes, with your roast, what have you. Now, the Irish are, besides known for their festivities, their eating and drinking goes along with that. Again, it's also their humor. And their humor mimics their society quite a bit. I don't think so much in a bad way. I think that most of the good, really good Irish-oriented jokes I ever got were in the military from people that were staunch Irish heritage, from like Hell's Kitchen in New York, GIs from there, and various other pockets of high concentrations of Irish heritage in our country. And I think they look at themselves with a humorous view. They keep cheery, which is a good thing, especially in these days. It's all doom and gloom in the news and stuff. There's no reason to do that. That spreads around you. It affects your health, etc. And because they do like their cheer, there's a lot of jokes around that. For instance, the Irishman that arrived at JFK Airport. Now, this is an old one. He wandered around the terminal with tears streaming down his cheeks. Just the absolute look of loss upon him. An airline employee saw him and asked, "Are you already homesick?" And the Irishman replied, "No, I've lost my luggage." And then the airline employee said, "Well, how'd that happen?" And he says, "The cork fell out." So you see, there's oftentimes these jokes, and of course, a lot of times the dirty limericks get associated with them, and the songs that are very racy in their content, and maybe they don't have any profanity, but there's plenty of allusions there in how they word things. Oftentimes, Irish priests are the butt of jokes. For instance, the priest that was driving to New York, he got stopped for speeding in old Connecticut, and the state trooper smelled alcohol all over his breath, and he sees an empty wine bottle on the floor, and he says, "Have you been drinking?" And the priest, of course, says, "No, just water." And the trooper says, "Well, then why do I smell wine?" And the priest looks at the bottle and says, "Good Lord, he's done it again." So see, there's a lot of humor oriented around the clergy, around festivities, the drinking, of course, being part of that. Doesn't mean they're all drunks. It's just part of the culture, Guinness and various other things being very synonymous. The world's oldest, and this is the documented fact, the oldest distillery, Bushmills, Irish whiskey, the longest and oldest operating distillery from the early 1600s. I don't have a bottle sitting here in the studio, but I believe it's like 1608 or something. And you'd be amazed at how much medical science, if you look back at the history of that distillery, how much medical science and regular science about how things change from one state to another came from European scientists working around that distillery, because they had such quality control standards even back in the older ages when they started. Very consistent, very controlled environment, and a lot of regular scientific experiments were done and conducted around these Irish distilleries. It's kind of a neat point there. a lot of what we know today about how substances change from one state to another came from such operations. Because once they saw the work in action and were developing their mainstay, liquor refinement, they quickly saw the usages in the plant, and let's play with potassium, let's play with pure sodium. So there is a lot of history that goes back to those. It wasn't just making liquor. And I think something to keep in mind, too, is, like I say, the history is very varied, a very oral history in Ireland for years and years because of the clan system. Now, the story of St. Patrick varies depending on sources, so I want to give you a few various ones here. A rough synopsis would be that he was a Christian missionary, and he was given the, St. Patrick's given them basically the credit for the conversion of Ireland from paganism. Okay? Finding the truth will probably never actually happen. A few things are known. He was born, in what is Britain now, to a Christian family, and as a teen he was kidnapped by an Irish raiding party and he was put into slavery. 6 years later, he escaped and made his way back to what's now Britain. Patrick says he received a divine call in a dream to return to Ireland as a Christian missionary. After he was ordained as a priest, he went to Ireland and spent the rest of his life converting pagans, founding churches, ordaining clergymen, etc. That's pretty much the agreed-upon point there, that he was the result of conversion from pagan to Christianity. He was the stimulus. He became a hero, obviously, in the Irish culture, and so much so that there are more than 60 churches and cathedrals named after him in Ireland alone. And one of the most famous, of course, being the St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin. That is the site where he was most famous for baptizing his converts, the main site. Now, depending on where you look, if you go to the World Book, for instance, he lived, supposedly, from 389 to 461 A.D. He's kind of the patron saint of Ireland. He became known as the Apostle to the Irish, his Latin name being Patricius. And as I told you, he was born in Britain. Now, his idea from the divine intervention, as he put it, or in a dream, as he also told, to go back, really drove him. He prepared himself by studying in a monastery in Lorenz. It's an island off the coast by France. And then he went on to Auxerre, France, and studied under Saint Germanus, who was a French bishop at the time. His superiors were really worried about his ability to be a missionary because of his inadequate and lack of education. But after Palladius, he was the first Irish missionary bishop who died in 431. Pope Celestine I sent Patrick to Ireland, and this is more of an official history from the church standpoint. He began where no one had really preached Christianity to several tribal leaders and soon made converts. Now, of course, you had to win over the tribal or clan leader before you could approach the rest of it. And in his time, he founded, now I said earlier, you know, some 60 church named after him. Don't get confused with this other. He founded, though, and got some 300 early Christian churches opened, and he's credited in some writings with baptizing more than 120,000 people. It got so large, he had to bring clergymen from England and France to support these new early Christian churches, the same people, in fact, that were leery about his ability to be a missionary. British, though, of course, God, they always got to be a stickler about something, except for people's rights. They opposed him greatly because of the way he organized his churches, so he just stayed his career in Ireland. Didn't need to deal with them, he felt. a lot of his personal writings are where we get a lot of the history of those Irish cultures in that period, because he was the only one really documenting extensively life, everyday life, the culture, the real thing. You have to remember that he, after his calling to God, he wrote a letter and to a British chieftain, because he saw in his early calling that he needed to kind of settle down the clans, he felt, to convert them. Now, Croticus, as he's referred to, led a raid and he killed a lot of his converts, St. Patrick's converts, that is. Now, he also, though, had to just as quickly write a letter in defense of the treatment by mainland Europe, I'll call it Western Europe's, clergy towards the Irish clans. They wrote them off as heathens, warriors, and that was about it. And he had to really show his disdain towards the bad and scornful attitudes of the British clergy, and that's part of the reason why he was most effective to stay in Ireland. You know, he found a place where he could do the calling that he had and saw a receptive audience for conversion to Christianity and didn't need to deal with the politics of the day that were predominated by France and England at the time. Theoretically, as far as his burial, there's different stories here, so these are all theories. He's possibly buried with St. Bridget at St. Columba at Downpatrick in the County Down. Now, here's the thing, though. His jawbone, I mentioned that earlier, theoretically, it's preserved in a silver shrine. And it was requested by clans and people oftentimes in childbirth, epileptic fits, and, like I told you earlier, preservative or block against the evil eye. Now, St. Patrick knew a lot of the old pagan rituals. That's why he was able to relate to the Irish, I think, so well. He knew where they came from. He knew a lot of their old, really mystery school and secret society religion that predominated the islands there, in the Celts, etc. And he knew how to use that to talk to the clans. The evil eye being one of those things. And in fact, oftentimes it's been mentioned that the Celtic cross is devised by St. Patrick, from a combination of this early solar or sun symbol with the magic, as in magic and majesty 12, spelled M-A-J-I-C, the magic circle. That's the culmination. The other story being that the trefoil and then the clover came to symbolize that, placed within a circle, to whereas a lapel pin is the inspiration for the Celtic cross. So a lot of this is really up to speculation, because the fact that the so-called developed Europe wrote off Ireland as just a heathen mongrel race of warriors and didn't really feel the need to document much when they were around there. Now, the chapel, if you're interested more in the religious standpoint as far as chapels, etc., so possibly St. Patrick died in Glastonbury and was buried there. Now, the chapel of St. Patrick is still part of the Glastonbury Abbey. There is evidence of pilgrimage by Irish to his tomb in the reign of during Saxon King Ain in A.D. 688. They were actually led, this group of pilgrims, by Saint Ithricus, and was murdered there. Now, a lot of this angst and anxiety to possess these bodies of saints that were killed by one clan or the other is what leads to the fact that a lot of these bodies end up strewn all over. Burial places are basically unknown. Now, some of the more folklorish history of St. Patrick, is the tail of the snakes. Now, this is a little more symbolic than most people give credit to, and we'll get into that here in a little bit. We're kind of working our way through the rough history and some of the religious side and the folklore side, and we're going to get into a more symbolic mystery school observation that you hear often on the Hour of the Time. St. Patrick is credited, and the biggest tale about him, with charming the snakes of Ireland and running them into the sea so they'd all drowned. And that's theoretically why there's no snakes in Ireland. Now, supposedly he stood upon a hill, and he used a wooden staff. And a lot of this is derived, though, from the pagan ceremonies of the Druids with their oaken staffs. And many of you may know the significance of those with the Hollywood, and why we have a big Hollywood sign in Southern California. But he used that staff, and oftentimes referred to by some scholars as staff of divination, kind of a parallel to early biblical king's scepters, etc. He drove the serpents into the sea, and it's a lot of symbology, and banished them forever from Ireland. Another legend claims that one single snake resisted his influence, and he overcame it through cunning and trickery and ran him off as well, that individual snake. I think you'll see the origins of where that comes from. He is said to have made a box, a wooden box, and invite that single resistant serpent into that box. The snake kept saying the box is too small. The discussion became uptight, heated, what have you, argumentative. Finally, this snake came in to the box to prove that he was right, that he knew more than St. Patrick. Whereas St. Patrick slammed the lid upon the serpent and cast the box into the sea. Now, those of you who studied the mystery schools, etc., can see where all these different aspects of these tales come from. Now, the theory in scientific terms is that because they think that Ireland as an island broke off during the Ice Age, that's why there's no snakes there. But the other story, I think, is a little better. The scientific one's kind of boring. Now, you need to remember, as we get into this more so, the significance of the lone snake, the box, the staff, the clover, the trefoil, the clover placed within the circle of magic, M-A-J-I-C. And being that the serpent was a common item to be worshipped by pagans, druids, and mystery schools, and those societies who predominated through the power of the priesthood at the day, those who held the knowledge that were illumined. So him capturing the snake, even the final cunning one, and driving them that is symbolic more of his move into Ireland and causing the religious conversion to early Christianity. Now, according to another tale, he used a three-leaf shamrock. Now, this one's quite common to illustrate the Trinity. And that is where most people give credit of the shamrock, the three-leafed one, becoming kind of a symbol of Ireland. And today is his feast day, March 17th, and that's why it's celebrated as a national holiday. But how he did that, supposedly, was he was preaching and to the clans. And people said, well, you haven't seen the Holy Trinity, so how do you know it exists? And he picked up this clover, and then the crowd, in one instance, pursued him, and said, well, how can they be as one? The concept of a Trinity. And he says, does this shamrock not have three leaves? And they said, well, yeah. And the three leaves are separate, but they're all one flower. And that was an easy layman's way to get people to the concept, because a lot of it was language barriers as well. Now, St. Patrick, though, also introduced the Roman alphabet and Latin literature into Ireland. And that, as a result, the Irish monasteries became the centers of learning in Ireland. Again, his death roughly 461 A.D. I think that's an agreed-upon fact there. Because of what he was doing, and him, let's say, bucking the system of Western European, their ideas of how you should Christianize and whose heads you should just cut off because they're not deemed salvageable, convertible. His life was constantly threatened. It didn't bother him. He still traveled all over, confirmed, preached, opened churches, monasteries, and his epistola, as it's called, pleads the case of the Christian Irish to the hands of British invasion at one point. A lot of the credit, again, because of language barriers and cultural differences and constraints of clan systems and the tribal system, is the fact that his writings were very simple yet eloquent and to the point, but at the same time, he was the cause for higher education entering at the time. The Shamrock. Now, there's various inferences here. I told you about the supposedly one theory of it being intertwined with the circle of magic in written English. Now, remember, this is in English. The first agreed-upon date for a reference to a shamrock comes from 1571. And in Irish, written actual Irish, as the Seamrog, and that's from 1707, okay? It was a badge to be worn on your lapel on the saint's feast day. And it was referred to for the first time, though officially, as late as 1681. So, English derivative from the 1571, referred to officially, we'll say, 1681, and as a symbol to be worn on Saint's Feast Day. And then 1707, though, officially pops up in Irish writings as a whole around 1707. It was used as an emblem, mind you, of the Irish volunteers during the era of Grattan's Parliament, which is the early 1770s, or I should say in the 1770s, and before the 1798 and the Act of the Union. Or Act of Union. Queen Victoria, because the wearing of the shamrock was so indicative of Irish independence, she made it illegal. And she called it a rebellion to be wearing it. So that Queen Victoria, she felt it proper to not allow the Irish regiments to wear it anymore. So, what they did, civilians and the Irish regiments, they would get a little piece of paper formed in a plus symbol, or cross, and color it green. So, you'll see here that it's for a long time been integrated into their symbology. Now, it also goes, though, with some other ones because of who he was working with, and he had to understand their history before he could approach them for an early Christian conversion. It also ties in with, if you've been a student of symbology, the mystery schools, etc., and a listener to the Hour of the Time, you'll understand this, but a lot of the symbology that came out of the French and Britain, the early lodges, became used over there in conjunction to, mainly as a recruiting tool, with the rose and the thistle and the leek. Predominantly for that combination, England, Scotland, Wales. So, but as a result of all this heyday and fighting and arguments and Queen Victoria's actions against the Irish regiments and even the Black Watch that's so famous that wore it, that today a member of the British royal family presents a shamrock to the Irish Guards Regiment of the British Army. I think they do that as kind of try to gain favor to this day besides the symbolism because they need someone who's a competent soldier. So they rely on and throughout history has quite often. The Irish were instrumental in development of what became modern military tactics. They didn't much see the purpose in standing in a line and getting shot at by British regiments and then standing there and then now it's your turn to shoot back and do volleys back and forth. A lot of the unconventional and guerrilla warfare tactics used basically movement and control. The basis of modern military doctrine came from Irish clans and how it was developed in the American colonies and how it was used throughout the Revolutionary War and in the Civil War extensively amongst Irish leaders on both sides of our Civil War here, the war between the states. Now, another history concerning the shamrock, though, is it's a small type of herb called the seroy. And its leaves are made up of three leaves, and it's basically just part of a class or family of clovers that's native to Ireland. They've, of course, been associated with good luck, especially the four-leaf clover. Hence, whence the four-leaf clover was placed, the special one, inside the circle of magic, you came up with the Celtic cross. Now, many people today simply use it as a symbol, most people wearing today, so they don't get pinched at work or have a sticker or sign up of a trefoil, as it's called also. They're probably not sun worshippers, quite honestly. Are they right in not knowing the history of the symbols they put up? No, but I doubt they're out to cut up anybody's heads and sacrifice them today. So, now, again though, the legend of the shamrock is connected on purpose, mind you, with the banishment of the serpent tribe from Ireland. Now, the reason that is because, theoretically, and this is all tied in with mystery school, early, early mystery school symbolism, going actually clear back to the, some of it derived from the Necronomicon. Also, back to the Assassins and the Brotherhood of the Snake. Snakes are theoretically never seen on trefoil. And, that is a herbal remedy, a class of plant that's an herbal remedy, by the way, to snake and scorpion bites. So you see how a lot of the cultural things tie into what the early herbal medicinal practitioners in a tribe or clan who were looked upon just as powerful because they were the one who helped you out when you was injured, sick, given birth, in times of strife for food even. And these guys were really influential on cultures throughout the world, no different in Ireland, and often looked to with the same authority, not superseding, but side by side with the chieftain of a given clan. It goes back, though, I told you, mystery school-wise, though, the Brotherhood of the Snake, the Assassins, the early Assassins, the first group of them, that is, and those from ancient Sumeria, more often connected with the Necronomicon, now, and the Mad Arab, etc., the theory of the Mad Arab, which is symbolic, by the way. We've covered all that on the air before, so you go back and order the CDs if you want to hear the whole history of those. But the Serpent Tribe of Ireland, besides the herbal significance there, which is a true thing, because the influence of the herbal healers within a clan or culture, in Arabia, the trefoil, or trefoil, is called the shamrocka. and it's sacred, or used to be, in Iran. And the reason being, because of the Persian triads. Now, at the same time, though, it's also a sacred plant to the Druids. Being that the trefoil, the triads of Persia, the Shamraka in Iran, the Assassins, Arabia, the Sumerians, because of that, and also a significant part of it was because of the three. Three being such a powerful number to the mystery schools and their religions. It's almost totally for sure that St. Patrick had a root grasp of this, having been amongst the cultures that is a slave of Irish raiding parties and clans at a very early age. So he saw its use day in and day out. Now, Irish slaves were treated, they're still slaves, don't get me wrong, but they were treated different. It's not like the Dutch Indies Trading Company and how they dealt with African slaves to America along the triangular trade routes, for instance, as far as sugar, rum, and slaves. Now, that gives you a good basis for why is there such a mixed up thing, and why are a lot of these celebrations very modifiable to somebody. Why are they held so steadfastly to Irish cultures in places like the nicknamed Hell's Kitchen in Boston, etc., and even back in Ireland, and why they can be modified to fix themselves to a locale, in the sense that because of the tribal clan system and how it developed in that locale and how it could be most effectively communicated, the language of symbology, the conversion from mystery schools, paganism, to early Christianity, each one was different because each clan had to be approached differently by St. Patrick. So that is kind of the differentiation amongst certain regions, and even how it got transformed and developed when, let's say, Irish immigrants hit and pocketed in certain areas of America, in early America, where they might be from a given county. And they would clan up again, as far as neighborhoods, the modern equivalent of a county or a tribal area. And then, intermixed though, or right next door, closer because of easier roads and more modern times, a clan from another area, and hence a lot of the traditions would get mixed. When back in Ireland, though, those two clans may have been on opposite ends of the island, and when, quite honestly, except the Irish were quite well known for traveling over and raiding places and hassling British troops and ships, etc. Typically in those times, your entire life, you never left 30 miles of where you were born. So, when you had traditions that were more local-oriented on opposite sides of an island, and then you're mixed in neighborhood type things in London, early America, the southern states even, the significance of individual eccentricities becomes mixed with other ones, and you get a more generic form of a cultural heritage. Now we're going to go to a musical break here with some more Irish music from a more modern band now, more mainstream. In fact, today there's a big festival in Mesa Amphitheater, the outdoor theater. Because of logistical constraints, I can't go there, unfortunately, which is probably a good thing, though. And play a little music here, go check on some food, and I'll be right back. And we're going to get into more of an academic side, a more critical eye of the symbology around today, St. Patrick's Day.
Too many pairs, so the streets are screaming at the people that I'm leaving, and he took the road for judgment.
gentlemen. Today you're listening to the Hour of the Time on Christian Media Network via AM and FM affiliate, satellite link, and internet feed. Today, Friday, the 17th of March, 2006, St. Paddy's Day or Saint's Feast Day. Now, for a more academic view of St. Patrick's Day, the symbology, its origins, etc., it's easy to use all the symbolism. It was quite effective to those early churches of all forms, as in just groups. Now, it was a controlling factor to use religion and symbology, especially the priesthood. The priesthood being those derivatives, the early possessors of the fire, the flame, the knowledge. And it spread around the world. Now, the patron saint of Ireland, Patrick, he's probably fictitious. Now, this is from a pure academic standpoint, not culturally. Probably a fictitious figure and built on the Roman pater or pater, or patricius or patricius, who a priest. The only evidence for the existence of a Christian Saint Patrick, if you look from a purely academic standpoint, is his own autobiography, supposedly written during the 400s, his death in 461, theorized, the 5th century, but not heard really until about 400 years later. Now, basically, it appears to academics and those who study the mystery schools that Patrick's writings, or purported writings, were actually forgeries by monks wishing to pretend for power, you know, manipulation, that Ireland was Christianized earlier than it actually was. The reason this would happen is because obviously the cultural power that the priesthood sought, but also there's a couple other incidences. For instance, in the 12th century, Saint Bernard, he complained that the Irish were still given over to barbarous rites, Christianity having failed to take root among them. That was what Saint Bernard said. Hence, why scholars of mystery schools and ancient religions sometimes think that, well, his conversion and writings and stuff during the 5th century, 7 centuries prior, had to have been a fictitious symbolic oracle, if you will, of the monk priesthood. Now, a lot of hagiography is involved here. What this is, this happened a lot during the 9th and 10th century among saints. Patrick had pagan precedences. One was an Irish god of the shamrock, which was called Trifungud del Escor, or Triple Bear of the Triple Key. Now, those of you who studied and listened to the Hour of the Time understand exactly what the Triple Bear of the Triple Key is. They had a plant assigned to them. This is quite common, besides a plant, a celestial symbol, and an animal. This god of the shamrock in Ireland, had a sacred plant, and it bore all edible fruits. Most importantly, though, it bore the apple of immortality. Now, he was a son consort of the triple goddess, whose triple yoni was represented by shamrock designs from the earliest civilizations of the Indus Valley. Now, the story about St. Patrick from an academic standpoint, research into the mystery schools, the story of him explaining the Christian Trinity via the shamrock was obviously apocryphal. The worship the Irish did worshiped the shamrock as a sign of their triple pagan deities. The Book of Leinster said Patrick's mother was the goddess Maka, and she of the feminine trinity who gave birth to the shamrock god, whose was in charge, and his plants bore all edible fruit, mainly the apple of immortality. Now, there are a lot of other stories that show a lot of the Patrick's true paganism. He was educated by a druid in Wales. In fact, he bore the title of Maenwen, meaning one dedicated to the moon. His martyrdom, the legend of it at least, indicated that he was sacrificed to a moon goddess. But, like a pagan god, he was united with her virgin incarnation, Bridget, or Brigit. The funerary temple at Downpatrick was dedicated both to Brigit and Patricius, or Patricus. We mentioned the theater, the cathedral earlier in Downpatrick. And the Welsh form of the triple goddess, Guinevere, was said to have slain the Irish knight Sir Patris, or Patricus, see? So, with her magic apple, mind you, is how she slayed him, recalling her goddess gift of an apple of immortality and giving that to each of her doomed lovers. Oh. Now, here's the thing. Now, the monks, as far as monks' versions, in their monasteries and how they wrote his pagan precedent was that he declared himself a sinner despised by many. The course that is more intertwined with the cultural icons and his threats from the British Empire for him preaching and turning these savages into Christians that were not like the British and French cathedrals and not like their monasteries. St. Patrick's Day, though, is actually known as, in the Roman Empire, that is, the Day of Apotheosis. Now, we covered in our 22-part ecumenical and series, Rob Tuccio and I, the differences here. This is Apotheosis, okay? And the Roman Empire, their Day of Apotheosis of the God slain during the Ides of March. Liber, or Liber, Pater, or Mars Pater, who would have been known as Patricus, or Patricius, or Patrick in Britain. Now, at the Roman festival on March 17th, by the way, a gigantic phallus, typical of the mystery schools, the phallic symbol like the Washington Monument. And, in fact, many of you, I don't know if you'll remember this, some of you, but do you remember the Christmas cards sent out by several politicians in the 80s. It wasn't just Buchanan that did it, mind you, but they were a phallus with a red bow tied around the base of it, and the phallus was the Washington Monument, the red bow at the bottom. Symbolized the genitalia. Again, the mystery schools working right out in the open. Okay? Now, again, the phallus here in the ceremonies in Rome, which was on March 17th, it was paraded around the streets and then solemnly crowned with a garland representing the divine Yoni by the hands of specially selected matrons. The phallus of Liber Pater was also known as the Palladium, planted in the womb temple of Vesta. Now, this always goes back and has ties with the mystery school. See here? Now, the priest who represented this god's power was the Pater Patrum, or Father of Fathers, or else the Peter, the phallic stone pillar, or else Palladius. Ancient chronicles mention a Roman Irish martyr called Bishop Palladius, who was, quote, the first bishop to the Irish who believe in Christ, end quote. Sacrificed to the Irish moon goddess before Patrick ever appeared culturally as an icon. Evidently both Palladius and Patrick were the same pagan god, adopted into the canon after his old shrines were taken over by Christians. So you see there, ladies and gentlemen, how that little blip of history and how that ties in with the mystery school religions and the symbology and the cultural oral presentation, the oral history, and its symbology of the serpent, the lone serpent, the box, casting him into the sea, his staff or staff of divination, the special lucky clover being four, into the circle of the magic being developed to a Celtic cross, or the trefoil, the shamraka from Iran and Arabias, the triads of Palestine. So you see here how these intermingling symbols pervade throughout different cultures and how they are used and manipulated, just like today, to influence people. That those self-anointed illumined ones, the bearers of the knowledge, those who are illuminated, those who see things in the dark, they release what they want you to see and know. And the intellect of a culture, society, group, let's bring it modern, think tank, non-government organization, NGO, etc., are held by members of a board that sit around table, and significantly, almost always have 12 or 13 seats. Both those numbers and why they sit around a round table, we've already went into in depth on the hour of the time. No time to cover it today. We're being day specific in this case. Not unlike we've done on some other holidays around the year. And if you're on our intelligence mailing list every day, which is free, if you request to be on it, when these pagan holidays and mystery school religions pop up throughout the year, we send you links and information on it in our daily newsletter. Usually it's actually twice a day is my preferred method, morning and evening. But a lot of the last more critical eye, the credit can be given to Miss Barbara Walker. She has a thing called a book called the Women's Encyclopedia Myths and Secrets. Now, she concentrated on those of the womb temples like Vesta and the Virgin Goddesses in her writings, hence the Woman's Encyclopedia Myths and Secrets. That's by Barbara Walker. Some of those last references between the known phallic symbol on March 17th celebrations in the pagan Roman Empire, the crowning of it with the garland representing the Yoni, and then, remember, they were tied together in the womb temple. Or, as usual, upon death, reunited with their virgin goddess. And in this case, it came through, so they could be reunited, through the apple of immortality after their physical death. So, ladies and gentlemen, there's a little tidbits about St. Patrick's Day. Everything from music to recipes to cultural stories to more academic eye at the symbolism. So I hope all of you have a wonderful and a studious afternoon and weekend, and a safe one at that. Think about how things like today pervade society and where they came from. And the next time someone tells you that, oh, there's no way what you're telling me about the Masons can be true, that this has been going on for hundreds of years and this symbol stands for that. You know what? A lot of times you can break the ice with someone, if they want to listen to you, that is, even the slightest bit, by making a correlation to something that's much more acceptable. And then get into the hardcore stuff. Don't hit them with Mystery Babylon, 43 CDs, the first time you